Thanks, Sultan. So Michael has expressed his disappointment that I was not going on as long as Nima, and I'm not sure that I have quite enough material to meet that challenge, but maybe if I'm feeling inclined, we'll go in that direction. So we saw a number of things last time, particularly the master equation expressing a amplitude, in our case a one-loop amplitude, as a sum over certain basis of integrals with rational coefficients, rational functions of the spinner products. And in general, there's an additional rational term in supersymmetric theories. It would be absent in QCD. It's present. We saw how one can, at one loop, derive that basis of integrals. And that basis, once we're willing to throw away terms of order epsilon, in the dimensional regulator, consists of these nine integrals, or if we're actually including the four-point function, as Michael points out, also the zero-mass box. So different configurations of boxes with one to four masses, likewise three different kinds of triangles, and finally the bubbles. And we're going to start actually by taking a closer look at the second of these basis integrals, the so-called easy two-mass box. Easy because it's easy to derive in all orders in epsilon expression, more or less on the back of an envelope. I'm not going to do that derivation for you. But so if we look at that integral, and there's probably some factors of I and possibly other constants that I will be a little bit sloppy about. In this lecture. Again, the external momenta here I'm labeling as, in this case, K1 through K4. And following the usual conventions, things with multiple indices are sums of external momenta. And, one can evaluate this integral. There's a certain combination of gamma functions and pi's to the epsilon, which I'll call C of gamma. And then there's a denominator, which you'll notice does not correspond to a physical singularity. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. We have pole terms in the dimensional regulator. And then there's a bunch of finite terms. Care about them for the purposes of next leading order or pure one-loop calculations, I'm going to go ahead and drop the terms of order epsilon.
Just to be absolutely clear, two of the
propagators
have masses?
No, all the internal lines, I should maybe remind you of that. So all the internal lines here are all massless. And the amplitudes we're starting with, all the original external momenta are also massless, so k squared equals zero. But when we do the reductions and we eventually end up with a basis, some of the arguments to the integral functions are actually sums of the original external momenta. And so, of course, for example, in general, S12 is non-zero, so in some amplitude. And so if that shows, if K1 plus K2 shows up as the argument of a box or a triangle, then that leg is massive. So from the point of view of the integral functions alone, then in this case, K1 squared and K3 squared are non-zero, but all the internal legs remain massless. So I'm suppressing the Feynman I epsilon here, but other than that, I'm suppressing nothing. So first question, I guess, is who knows what this function is? OK, those of you who don't, nothing to be embarrassed about. It's not something you typically study unless you become a particle physicist. So this is the dialogue. And I gather Marcus will say lots more about these functions on Thursday.
Thanks for asking that question, because otherwise my talk would have started at totally the wrong place.
Okay. So the dialogarithm, which is the simplest of this class of functions, which much to my surprise a few years ago I discovered in a small segment of the math community, are actually a very hot topic.
Andrew Hodges calls that the dog function.
The dog function.
One of his earliest papers.
Well, they've been known as the dialogarithm since the 19th century, so he's welcome to
L out of D-log.
So if you take a logarithm and you integrate it with a singular denominator, then you get a dialog. If you continue this process, then you get higher and higher polylogarithms. And it's believed that all massless Feynman integrals are expressed in terms of this kind of class of functions and its generalizations, although I don't think there's any proof of it. The other thing, just to make contact with those of you who remember the comment that Nima made in some point or other in his lecture, is one can also rewrite this in a form which just has 1 over u's, and this integral is then over the upper part of the square here. This goes up to x, and this is then the line 1 minus t. Now, another bit of the language you may hear in Marcus's talk or in many other n equals 4 talks is something called transcendentality. And that's, in a sense, the weight. You can classify these functions according to what the mathematicians would call their polylog weight. So for example, there's a series expansion one can derive for this dialogarithm simply by doing a series expansion for the logarithm and then integrating it. This is not the correct way to evaluate this function numerically, but it's useful for certain purposes. So the 2 here is the transcendentality. And in particular, one can usefully define the transcendentality of the logarithm and also of constants of pi to be 1. And similarly, the transcendentality of these dialogarithms along with the transcendentality, of the zeta constants is n. Zeta of n is simply the n-fold polylogarithm evaluated at 1. So zeta of 2, or pi squared over 6, is simply the dialog evaluated at 1. And more generally, the class of so-called generalized or Gontcharov polylogarithms has many indices. And also many x's, many arguments. And the weight in this case is the sum of the various exponents, so it would be n1 all the way through nm. And what's interesting about the transcendentality, if you look at amplitudes in n equals 4, then the transcendentality is equal to twice the loop order, and it's uniform. I don't believe there's any proof of that statement, but it certainly seems to be true in every calculation that anyone has done. In QCD, the transcendentality is mixed. It runs all the way from 0 to 2L, 0 here being a rational term, so a rational term is defined to have transcendentality 0. So another thing that we should look at a little bit, so this particular integral is ultraviolet finite. We can see that just by power counting. So the...
Can you just say a couple more words about this transcendentality? Is it a function or a number that has transcendentality?
Actually, if I gave you the numerical expression for zeta of 2, right, then in that sense, it's hard usefully to talk about the transcendentality, right? Because there's always some finite rational approximation you're making to it. So what actually has a transcendentality are certainly functions of variables, but also symbols, which are constants. So you have to have a symbolic representation. It's not enough to have a numerical expression to be able to assess the transcendentality of
something. Function has a certain transcendentality. Does that mean that every point where that function is evaluated has the same transcendentality?
Yes. Yes, but it has to be evaluated as a symbolic expression. Sure. So Li 2 of 1/2 is also transcendentality 2, but if you actually, you know, gave me 50,000 digits in Mathematica, I would say, well, that's actually a rational number, so that's...
Is it defined for any function, or...?
Is it defined for any function? I would say no, it's defined for these polylogarithms, and these generalized polylogarithms, and associated constants, which are the multi... I'm sorry?
It has to do with your statement that Feynman integrals are evaluated as a linear combination of these specific functions.
Actually, first of all, that's also a statement which is not proven even in a highly symmetric theory like n equals 4. But it is believed that all integrals where there's no internal masses can be evaluated in terms of this class of functions. And it is known that it is not true if you have a sufficiently complicated set of masses on the inside, then it is not true that you can evaluate such integrals in terms of polylogarithms. You need things that are elliptic functions and generalized elliptic functions.
The number grows,
and first of all, I'm not even sure that there's is it actually known that the Stifel and Shuffle relations exhaust all possible identities between?
I think it's technically a conjecture, but it's
okay. I mean, it's probably true. It's probably true. And then the question is it actually, I mean, there must be some way to count these things, but I don't know. Is it an exponentially growing number, or is it slower growing within?
Claude's talk, he explained the classification, but I don't.
But he didn't explain the counting. I don't know the answer to that, but basically the dialogue is, so transcendentality 2, there's essentially the dialogue and the log squared, and you could count pi squared as a separate one. So if you're looking just at real pieces, there's sort of three independent symbols that you would need. At transcendentality 3, then you'd have also things like log times dialogue, and there's actually trilog of x and trilog of 1 minus x, which are independent functions. So then there you would have a 4. And the number grows as you go to higher transcendentality, but I don't know at what rate.
So if I have a function that has a Taylor series,
I'm sorry, that
if I have a function that I know it's Taylor series in some region, can I evaluate the transcendentality by looking at the growth of the coefficients?
I think that you have to know what really is determining the transcendentality here, and the way that I would think about generalizing it to elliptic functions is to know something about the branch cut structure. And that's something which is not easily visible in a Taylor expansion. So I think the answer is no. But of course, if you could resum it, then you would know. So just to continue back with our integral, then there are no ultraviolet divergences here. You can see that by power counting. So the singularities that emerge are infrared singularities. And we'll see in a minute how to understand them a little bit more. But these things basically arise when you have multiple propagators which are vanishing at the same point or the same subsurface of the region of integration. One propagator vanishing, you can sort of heuristically see that by power counting, that one propagator vanishing is going to be safe because I have more powers in a certain sense of L in the numerator than I have in the denominator. When you have two adjacent propagators separated by a massless leg that are vanishing, so for example, these two propagators, then that will give you a collinear divergence. And when you have three that are vanishing, then you'll get a soft singularity. And of course, those singularities can actually overlap. And typically, or characteristically in a gauge theory, there's actually two powers of epsilon that arise at every order in perturbation theory. So that at one loop, you'd get a maximum of 1 over epsilon squared, at two loops, 1 over epsilon to the fourth, and so on and so forth. And in fact, for the purposes of this transcendentality counting, you can treat a 1 over epsilon as also having transcendentality 1. That makes the counting in n equals 4 uniform. So in particular, in the one mass and hard two mass cases, you would expect there's three consecutive propagators that are sandwiching massless legs. And so here you'd expect a genuine 1 over epsilon squared. And here and here you'd expect just a 1 over epsilon. And here, in fact, there's no massless legs at all. So you're not going to be able to get two singular propagators, and there should be no infrared divergences at all. What's happening here? Well, it looks as though there's 1 over epsilon squared, but if we actually carry out the expansion, then what we find is that we get the same prefactor, of course, and the leading term is going to be 1 plus 1 minus 1 minus 1. And so that's going to cancel. And we're just going to get a logarithm times the 1 over epsilon. And now I'm just not going to write out all the terms that are actually finite and that we do care about. So characteristically, in a gauge theory, the 1 over epsilon squares from the integrals that do have them are going to be multiplied by rational functions. And the 1 over epsilons are going to be multiplied by logarithm. It's kind of the characteristic form in which you also would find in the final answer. Now, these singularities ultimately have to cancel singularities that arise in real emission. And those singularities are maybe easier to understand physically. They arise from situations where you have, let's say, a gluon that's becoming soft. This is exactly the analog to soft photon radiation that I'm sure everyone at some point or other saw in their graduate field theory course. And the other phenomenon that can happen in QCD is that a gluon can become a collinear to a quark or to another gluon. And that, again, in a real emission amplitude, will give you a singularity that ultimately produces a 1 over epsilon when you do the real emission integrations in dimensional regularization. I'm not really going to have time to go through all of that, because that's it would be a subject of a whole other lecture. But what we can do is just to sketch out the way in which the singularities arise in the loop integral, and just to understand how you can make some steps in making the match with the real emission. So let's imagine looking at some integral. Yes?
Just one question, curiosity. Just by looking at the initial integral, is it possible to simplify the integrand to get only the leading transcendentality pieces? In that direction?
Again, the statement that is believed to be true but not proven is that these integrals are, in a sense, very close to being dual conformal. I don't know if those words, if you've been to talks where those words are defined. And it's believed that all so-called pseudo-conformal integrals are of uniform transcendentality. It's also the case that there are integrals which are also of uniform transcendentality that are not dual conformal, so it's not only those integrals. But generally speaking, other integrals typically will have mixed transcendentality. So one way of sort of separating out the terms would be to write the integrals in terms of integrals which are pseudo-conformal plus some other stuff which has less than maximal transcendentality, although in general things will have mixed transcendentality. So at one loop it's kind of trivial because you know everything explicitly, and at higher loops it's still an open question exactly how you'd go about doing that kind of classification. I mean, we know a lot of things about the basis of two loops, but all the different possible ways of writing it are not really been worked out yet. So let's take I'm going to use a slightly different parameterization to write this out. And so again, if we imagine we have a loop integral, and now let me put in the Feynman epsilons, although instead of writing them as epsilons to avoid confusion with the dimensional regulator, I'll write them as delta. So let's imagine actually that we're maybe switching our attention to the hard two-mass box or some other integral. It potentially could even have three consecutive singular propagators, and then there would be some other propagators that in general cannot vanish simultaneously, and I'll just call this part of the integrand f of L. It's some function, which I don't really care about. So what we want to do is to first of all do the L naught integration by a contour integration. And here's where we have to be careful about where exactly the poles are that are separated from the real axis, from the L0 contour by the I delta. And typically, we're going to get some form like this. The solutions are going to have form like this, and the contour will enclose one of them and leave the other one on the other side. Of course, you can close the contour in either direction. And let's focus here on the, I mean, there's a number of poles here, and ultimately you have to sum over all of them, but let's focus on one particular pole, the one that's essentially arising from solving the middle propagator. So if we write out the contribution there, then again, dropping various constant prefactors, we're going to get the spatial integration that's left over. And there's going to be this function evaluated at the solution, which is L0 equals, in this case, we're going to choose minus L as the, we make the, that choice. And I'm also going to define E1 to be the time component of K1 and E2 to be minus the time component. And I'm going to assume that those E1 and E2 are both positive. So the form that I'm going to get when I evaluate this residue is going to be this is the factor of L. I just write out the residue. So the other two propagators are, I'm just substituting in the value. And we can see that the region that's going to be relevant here is ultimately going to be the soft region where the magnitude of L is roughly zero. And we can simplify those other propagators there. Each one of them is going to give us something of this form. So we're going to pick up another factor of the norm of L. And finally, there's going to be a factor which is a cosine with respect to the direction of the integration variable. So that's it's this form which is going to get substituted for 1 and for 2 over here. So when we do that, then we'll see there's an L cubed, a norm of L cubed in the denominator. There's essentially an L squared DL in the numerator, so we're going to get a DL over L. It's basically a logarithmic divergence, except that it's regulated by this minus 2 epsilon. So we're going to get one singularity that's coming from the region where the norm of L is going to 0, and that's exactly corresponding to the soft gluon singularity you'd see in real emission. And there's also an angular integral. And this denominator is going to vanish. There's going to be two of these for I equals 1 and 2. And when the appropriate cosine, which I think there should be a minus sign here, but when the appropriate cosine goes to when the appropriate cosine goes to 1, so that the angle is going to 0, in other words, L hat is pointing, that is the spatial component of the loop momentum is pointing in the same direction as the adjacent external momentum, then again, we're going to get a vanishing denominator. And that denominator, again, is going to be regulated by a d theta integral. So we're going to get something that's roughly of the form d cosine theta over cosine theta or d theta over theta. Again, there's going to be a theta to the minus 2 epsilon coming from the measure that's going to regulate it. So when we do that integral, then there's going to be, again, another 1 over epsilon. And there are two regions here, basically, when it's collinear with K1 or collinear with K2 that are going to contribute. On the other hand, if this leg were to become massive, then all of a sudden, I'd actually have an extra contribution here that involved the mass of that particle, and that would regulate this singularity. So when we have a massless particle and two adjacent propagators, then we're going to get a collinear singularity. So there are a number of other singularities that, actually, there's one other singularity that we can see inside the two-mass box, returning to this situation. There's a factor in front which is very clearly not a physical singularity. There's no there's no factorization, for example, in field theory. There's nothing that you'd look at an amplitude and you'd expect to diverge when you have a certain relation between S and T and the masses involved in the problem. And in fact, that particular form we can write in a very suggestive way. We can actually factorize it as long as we're willing to use spinner expressions in this form. And again, so we can write it in terms of a spinner string and its conjugate. And if you think back to Ruth's lectures last week, at least for those of you who were there, these are exactly the planar kinds of singularities that showed up in the denominators of the BCFW forms of various tree amplitudes. And there are, of course, also spurious singularities that showed up in Nima's talk. So here we have a factor of this in front, but in fact, it's not a singularity of the Feynman integral. One can demonstrate that in various ways. So the question is, what's actually going on here? And the answer is that there's a cancellation between this singularity in front and the transcendental functions that show up inside the integral. And the simplest one to examine is this particular dialogue. So we have a dialogue of 1 minus m1 squared m3 squared, excuse me, divided by st. We can see that, of course, the dialogue, as its argument goes to 0, is going to vanish linearly. So we have essentially 1 over the argument here, and then there's a numerator, which is that argument. So the product of these two is actually going to be finite as you approach the singular region. And you can actually show that the remaining dialogues combine in the correct way to also cancel off this singularity. For example, if we look at the 1 over epsilon term, then in that region, the numerator and denominator become equal. So again, this logarithm is approaching logarithm of 1, and that again will vanish linearly to soften the singularity to a constant. So in spite of the appearance here, there is actually no spurious singularity in the integral, but the cancellation is non-trivial. And there's another kind of cancellation that is even more non-trivial that can arise, that you can get, for example, functions if S1 and S2 are some invariants in some multi-particle amplitude. You find that there are, in general, contributions in QCD, contributions of this sort to the amplitude. Again, when two invariants approach each other, that's not a physical singularity of amplitudes. What's happening here is that actually one of these powers, S1 minus S2, of course, as S1 approaches S2, the logarithm will also vanish. That'll soften this singularity to something that's actually the negative of this one, and the two of them will then combine to cancel and leave something finite. But the point is that there can be an intricate softening coming from the interplay of spurious singularities and transcendental functions. And then there can also be cancellations between transcendental functions and rational terms. So depending on the structure of these coefficients, it may well be that each coefficient has spurious singularities that will either cancel with when you're multiplying by the corresponding integral, or that cancel between different terms, between different integrals, or between different integrals and the rational functions. Any questions at this point?
If the momenta are real, then shouldn't ST be negative, and then there's not actually a singularity?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking of this as an analytic function of the invariants, right?
It looks like there's a singularity, or even if there were one.
In general, first of all, in general, these things, remember that these things are multi-particle invariants in some, and M1 squared and M3 squared also multi-particle invariants in some higher point amplitude. So in fact, you can actually probe this planar region. and then you will, in fact, actually hit that singularity surface even in principle, even in the physical region. But there's no singularity there, so there's nothing to worry about, except possibly if you're doing it in too low precision computer arithmetic, you might have to worry about isolating a little pole. I think a little circle around it. I think if you're working in double precision, then with usual kinds of statistics, let's say, you know, 10 to the ninth or 10 to the 10th events, it's just not something you have to worry about.
It looks like a single
Nestle
square is sufficient to give you one.
No, I mean, so remember, there's two different regions that contribute, right? And if I put in a mass in both of these places, then I'm regulating both of these singularities. So there's no 1 over epsilon. Moreover, I'm also getting rid of the soft singularity because one of the factors of L came from inside those propagators. So if I put in two masses here, then I get rid of all the divergences. Now, what you're saying is if I put in only one mass, then I still have a collinear divergence over here. And that's true. I do.
So 2mE also.
Because, yeah, I mean, I would have to make M2 also massive. And that's just the point that it's to get a collinear divergence, it's sufficient to have two adjacent vanishing propagators, and that's what I would still have if only one, if I only put in one mass.
Right, so you don't need two adjacent massless legs.
No, you need two adjacent massless legs to get a 1 epsilon squared, a genuine 1 over epsilon squared. For 1 over epsilon, it's sufficient to have one massless leg.
Is there any way to anticipate these spurious poles just by looking at the integrand?
Well, to the extent that they're ultimately canceled, at least in the simple integrals, by the actual transcendental functions, and the structure of the arguments is given ultimately by the algebraic geometry that's determined by the Feynman integrand, in some abstract mathematical sense, the answer is yes. But I don't think there's really any simpler way to do it than ultimately working out the integral, because once you've worked out what those arguments can be, what the 1 minus M1 squared M3 squared over ST can be, what that actually is, then you've gone most of the way to actually working out what the integral is.
I guess I'm just because the prefactor 1 over ST minus M1 squared M3 squared looks pretty benign or naive. I just wonder whether one could have guessed from the kinematics.
Well, in one loop, of course, you know the answer. So once you know the answer, it's easy to guess it. But if you ask, for example, what's the generalization of that factor when I go to the 4-mass box, or what's the generalization of that factor when you go to some generic 3-loop integral, I don't think it's easy to guess it ahead of time. So, I'm not even sure there's a good way to rationalize it a posteriori.
So, why are you saying that this is ground determinant?
I mean, it is a kind of, I actually didn't say it was a kind of a, but it is a kind of ground determinant. You can think of it that way.
Why are you saying it is difficult to anticipate that these kind of structures will appear?
I mean, there will be these kinds of structures, but if I write down some generic two-loop integral, you're going to be able to tell me exactly which ground determinant shows up in the denominators. Okay, that's really. I mean, in one loop, you know the answer, so it's.
Or you could just
I don't need to guess anything.
Singularity, right? You evaluate the Jacobian. You have the 4 propagators, so you evaluate determinant of the partial derivatives of the propagators with respect to the 4. Loop variables evaluated at one of the leading singularities, and you get exactly 1 over that rational function.
Okay. Yeah, actually, some.
But that's hard to carry out at higher loops.
Right.
The principal issue.
Right. I think that for integrals that have a maximal number of maximal cut, then I think it should be possible to do that. But for integrals with less than maximal cut, it's which in a sense don't have a leading singularity in the strict sense, then it's not so clear. So one of the other things that we saw last time was the fact that we can reconstruct loop amplitudes from their unitarity cuts. And the way we actually did that was to freeze two propagators, to turn two propagators into delta functions. And that then left us with the need to reconstruct an integrand and do certain algebraic reductions, which mimicked the integral reductions that we did to obtain a basis. And it picked out a subset of contributions every time we picked two specific propagators. So we had, let's say, some loop amplitude, and when we took a cut, then we would only get a subset of all possible functions, let's say the functions that actually had a discontinuity in a channel corresponding to the sum of momenta on one side of the cut. So what we'd like to do is to iterate that and cut more propagators, because that way we can isolate a smaller set of contributions. And in particular, if you imagine instead of just doing an ordinary cut, which would give you, let's say, the sum of a bubble and a certain number of triangles, and then a whole set of boxes that would have cuts in that channel, we can imagine going and cutting three legs, so replacing three propagators with delta functions. And first of all, it's clear that there's no bubbles in that case. It's clear there's a smaller set of triangles, because not all the triangles will share, let's say if we started out by cutting these two lines, then cutting this line will freeze the configuration of these two legs. Likewise, we'll have a smaller set of boxes. And similarly, we can also go and cut four lines. So we would then have eliminated the triangles, eliminated the bubbles, and moreover, we'd be freezing the specific configuration of legs in the box, because we cannot just move this leg over there. That would change the quadruple cut or fourfold cut that we're doing. So if we go from replacing two propagators by delta functions to four propagators, then we can narrow down the contribution to a single box integral, and we can really pick out the coefficient of a single box over there. We can't go beyond, at least in if we're interested in dropping the order epsilon pieces, we can't go beyond four cuts, because we would then actually be generating a distribution rather than generating a rational function, and that's not something that we want to do. So there's we're going to take some integral, and for the purposes of extracting the coefficient here, the distinction between d and 4 is not really that important. We really want to just think of it as four propagators and cut those four propagators. So we're going to replace the four propagators with four delta functions. So imagine that we have a box integral, and we had four propagators, which we're now replacing by delta functions. So the first problem that we encounter is that, strictly speaking, this object would vanish, because these delta functions don't actually have any real solutions. So these things we need to treat morally as delta functions, but really one needs to think of them as contour integrals, so that one has to allow for solutions which do not lie in the region of integration. So one has to think of these things as picking up the complex solutions to the corresponding sets of equations. And that's, you can phrase that in a number of different ways. You can imagine replacing the contour of integration for the L integrations. There's four contours. You replace that with contours that encircle the simultaneous solutions to the equations where the propagator denominators vanish. And we'll see in a minute how many solutions, and then we'll look at a couple of examples. But basically, if we now apply this cutting, this generalized cutting fourfold cut to the master equation from the left-hand side, we have the sum over all Feynman diagrams. We are actually putting these lines on shell. And if we remember from the BCFW equations, it doesn't really matter from the point of view of computing tree amplitudes whether you want to think of it in terms of Feynman diagrams or you want to think of it in terms of BCFW on shell recursion. It doesn't really matter whether the momenta are real or not. What really just matters is the momentum is conserved and each external momentum has k squared equals zero. So we're going to get a sum of the tree amplitudes corresponding to the four corners of the box. And there's a sum over helicities and whatever other internal quantum numbers may arise. There's also a Jacobian. So the box we're looking at and this here, I've drawn them as having many legs, but in fact, they might just have a single massless leg. So that's a three-point amplitude. Again, if the momenta were real, this thing would vanish. But we know that for complex momenta, in general, we have non-vanishing results. So that's something that carries over to that situation. And from the right-hand side, in contrast, we have the coefficient, of course. It's completely unaffected by this operation, so the CJ. And then we have the same Jacobian from cutting the loop amplitude. And then we're summing over the solutions to this fourfold set of delta functions. So naively, there are four quadratic equations. You might think that you should get 16 solutions. We'll see in a minute what the correct counting is. The thing that's interesting here is that if we now equate these two sides, we simply get an equation that says the coefficient is given by a certain sum over internal quantum numbers of a product of four on-shell trees evaluated in general at complex momenta. There's no more integral reductions. There's no more symbolic algebra that has to be done. So in this form, we now have an equation that we could, of course, do analytically, symbolically, if we chose to, but we could also implement numerically. So if we had some numerical means of computing these tree amplitudes, we can calculate this coefficient numerically.
Right. So you see, since there's only one way to cut it, why are you summing over on the left-hand side?
I mean, I'm summing over, for example, there's different helicities. So I have to do that sum, for example. And there can be other quantum numbers, you know, electroweak quantum numbers or things like that that have to be summed over.
Before we get to
yeah.
So in the original unitarity masses, we basically derived everything from this unitarity of the aspect. Right?
Yes.
Where does this equation follows from?
It follows from, first of all, understanding that, there's a generalization of this operation of cutting propagators, and then simply applying that operation to both sides of an equation. To my taste, there's not really a good sort of unitarity interpretation of this operation, although I think there are some people who might claim there is. I don't know what you would say. It's not, in that strict sense, it's not a fundamental property of field theory the way that basic unitarity is, but it's kind of a cousin or sibling of it.
So you would do this by looking at Feynman diagrams?
For example, you could think of it that way. There's probably, as I say, if you think back to the first words or the first panel in the previous lecture, in principle, the idea is that we should free ourselves entirely of the Lagrangian and Feynman rules and things like that, and we're not quite there at having a clean derivation from some first principles that's completely divorced from that.
Another observation that might be related that here, in contrast to standard traditional unitarity cut, you didn't write the plus on the delta.
That's correct. In fact, of course, I've said it, but maybe I should repeat it, that you cannot treat these are sort of the Cheshire cat of delta functions, in that you have them freezing the thing to the simultaneous solution of the equations, but you cannot interpret them literally as delta functions in terms of some delta convergent distribution or something like that. You have to interpret them as contour integrals, and you have to interpret the operation now not as simply taking a propagator and replacing it by some delta convergent sequence, but really as leaving the propagator alone and modifying the contour from the contour along the real axis to one that encircles the so-called global residue, that is the simultaneous solution of these equations.
The correspondence, because we have the I epsilon, so the propagator is not quite 1 over L squared, but then it is plus I epsilon.
But that's relevant. I mean, what the I epsilon is really telling you is that when the contour is running along the real axis, there's a pole that's trying to pinch it, and ultimately, it's the fact that some of these integrals get trapped between those poles is what's preventing you from getting a rational answer, and is forcing you to have all these transcendental functions. And what we're doing here is we're saying, forget about that. Just take the contour and move it somewhere else. So you're really computing a different quantity. This quantity is not, you do not get just by moving the contour and taking into account of all the poles you've crossed and stuff like that. You're replacing the original integral by a different object.
So you're saying forget about all the singularities that they pitch in the real axis, but look
that's
at
correct.
These.
That's
far
correct.
Off the real axis.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's another in the modern standard representation, right, for two particle scattering. First you compute the double cut, right? Then you look at the singularity structure of the cut function, and then you get the modern standard representation, not physical region. Right?
There are some integrals where cutting multiple times in a physical invariant is the same thing as doing these generalized cuts, but that's not true in general.
And how do you know that you can apply this iteration to both sides of this equation? The iteration is sort of, let's say, ill-defined, right, to begin with. So we apply ill-defined iteration to the left-hand side.
Why is it ill-defined?
Well, since I'm a physicist rather than a mathematician, then I have something that is a...
You start from a well-defined sum of Feynman diagrams, you have to be able to derive this equation and then define this equation uniquely, and then say, okay,
it's not operating.
Well, we have Feynman diagrams, so we can.
But
we
do have Feynman diagrams. You guys don't.
Well,
you read yourself.
For issues, no. If you listen to David. If you listen to David, he said that this is the one spot we have not freed ourselves completely. So for any kind of subtle issue, like worrying about I epsilons and delta functions, then it's really true. Secretly at night, we look at climate.
So I think the way to think about that is that the only calculations you're allowed to do with Feynman diagrams are Gedanken calculations. You're never actually allowed to calculate a formula or a number. And ultimately, I'm sure that there is a way of doing these derivations that avoids these issues. I just don't know it here, and I don't know it today. And moreover, it's not really the point of this lecture to do a rigorous formal derivation. I'm trying to give people an understanding of how it works and how you'd actually go about calculating. Yes, Michael.
So you have this contour, and you make it encircle a specific pole for complex L. Now, can I choose different contours that encircle different poles, and I get a consistency test from that? Or do I have to have the contour encircle all the poles?
In general, I think you need to have the contour encircle all the poles. However, at least at low loop order, it's possible to put functions, for example, like epsilon invariance in the numerator, that have different behavior around different poles. And so then you can form algebraic equations that, in some sense, isolate the, I'm not sure you can isolate the contribution of every single pole, but you can isolate contributions of subsets. Let me think about this for a second. Maybe in the case of, let's say if I'm thinking of two loops, in the case of integrals that have maximal, sorry. Well, I think at one loop you can effectively isolate every single global residue independently, but I'm not sure that that's a general statement.
We know that there is a simple algebraic property which makes this true, and there is a term which is fully standard. We don't sound absolutely, we don't get the equation for the integrals.
Yeah, I mean, why do you want to?
I mean, this is a simple algebraic property that has nothing to do with Feynman graphs, it's just that if you have a rational function,
I think we're getting a little bit off on a tangent here, because the issue is not sort of what's the rigorous derivation and what are all possible quantities that you could extract here, but how do you actually go about extracting the quantities that we care about, namely the coefficients in the amplitude, and that you do by summing over the solutions, and that statement more or less does in fact generalize.
Russell's argument should catch up to a Gottlieb thing, like the sum of the solution.
Well, if on the right hand side, you're basically, this product in a sense is one, right? And so then you're summing over everything, and so that's, if you sum one over all solutions, you just get the number of solutions. Not anything profound. The subtlety, maybe in a sense, is why do you know, is Kirill's question, why do you know that you can apply this operation, which I'm trying to heuristically motivate as just a generalization of the unitarity operation.
But you also don't sum over all solutions, you average over some solution, right?
No. I'm summing, right now in the derivation, I'm summing over solutions, and what you're going to say is, yes, that in order to solve for Cj, I need to take this expression and divide by the number of solutions, and that's true. Well, it's still true. I mean, not everything that's true is necessarily obvious. Since we're running.
Regarding Michael's question, so if you choose a contour that encloses all the poles, do you have to worry about the behavior of infinity?
I'm not quite sure
because the other
about
you
the
have
question.
To the contribution from the infinity.
No, the, I mean, again, the operation here is not, you're not, you should not be thinking of this as taking the physical contour and trying to deform it in some clever way. I'm taking that contour and I'm replacing it by something different. And that contour is chosen to enclose the global residue. In general, so I'm jumping a little bit ahead to material I'm probably not going to end up having time to cover. If I look at the triangle, for example, then I actually have three delta functions. So, and these again are still going to be delta functions I need to interpret in a complex sense, but there's one surviving integral, which I can parameterize by some complex parameter, and I've chosen the contours for the orthogonal directions to encircle a certain residue, and I have one contour left over, which I need to choose in a certain way. And that choice can encircle a pole at infinity, or it can encircle a pole at zero. If I choose to encircle the pole at zero, I don't add on an additional contribution from infinity. I'm just doing that remaining contour integral.
So are you going to show one explicit?
I'm going to show two explicit examples if people have the patience. And if people are getting bored or don't have the patience, then I'll sort of indicate points where it's safe to walk out and what you're going to overlook by walking out. So let's just, so again, the idea is that we can compute the coefficient of any of the box integrals by isolating a specific quadruple cut, and that's something where we just do algebra that could in fact be done numerically because we don't need to do any more symbolic stuff. So the, if I now look at the equations, then we would have equations of this form. And by subtracting multiples of the first equation, then we can see that we will change these equations to have three linear equations and one quadratic equation, and so then the naive counting turns out to be correct. There are two solutions to the equations. And so that number is going to be two, and there are basically two choices that we need to sum over. Well, I mean, in the general case, in fact, in all the cases, for generic momenta, that is the situation, of course, it's perfectly true that you could do something pathological, like choosing, if you have all the external legs are massless, you choose them all to be, you know, you can choose K1 and K2 to be collinear and make S equal zero, and then things are ill-defined. But for generic momenta, there's no issue here. So let's see here. We have time for one example. And let's, oh, why not? Let's do the n equals 4 example. Let me just do one bit out of a lower point example just to establish one general observation. So let's just look at one property. So let's look at one particular contribution in the 5-point amplitude, which of necessity is either MHV or MHV bar. And of course, they're related by parity, so we can just pick an MHV amplitude. And in QCD, the places where you insert the negative velocity gluons matter. You can't just move them around. On the other hand, if we were doing the n equals 4 theory, then in fact I can choose the negative helicity gluons to be more or less wherever I like, because there's a supersymmetry Ward identity, or equivalently, all these things, as Nima discussed last week, are packaged into a single object, and I can choose to compute whichever object of those that I like. So here I have to sum over helicities in principle, and so I'm going to have some helicity here and a negative helicity over there, and so here I have two negative helicities. That means that here I have to have two positive helicities, because otherwise at tree level I'm going to get a vanishing amplitude if all helicities are negative, or if there's only one negative helicity. So that then fixes the helicities over here to be minus and minus, and here I have a sigma 1 and minus sigma 1, and we can create a little table, sigma 1 and sigma 2. So if we have a negative helicity gluon here and a negative helicity gluon there, then both of these guys are positive. We have three pluses. And again, the three-point amplitude with three pluses vanishes, so we don't need to worry about this situation. Now, if we have, let's say, a plus and a minus, then, let's see here. So then we would have a minus here, and we of course have a plus here, a plus, and then a plus. So you'll notice that these two vertices, which are adjacent, have the same chirality. And we can ask, what about the lambda spinner that's associated, in this case, with the L5. Let's label it, so lambda L5. Well, we know that this the lambda spinner for a plus plus minus vertex, all the lambda spinners have to be proportional, right? We have, in the case of a minus minus plus, it would be the lambda tildes. And in this case, it's going to be the lambdas. So on the one hand, we have to have lambda L5 is proportional to lambda 5. And on the other hand, we also have to have lambda L5 that's proportional to lambda L4. And that's only possible if these two spinners, which are external spinners, are proportional. But that's in general not true. These are arbitrary momenta that are given. So these two contributions, these two equations cannot be true in general, and that means that this particular configuration is simply going to give a vanishing contribution. And there's of course a similar contribution with a similar structure, so these two we can get rid of. And that's actually a very general feature, that whenever we have two adjacent three-point vertices, they have to have opposite chirality. So if one of them is plus plus minus, the other one has to be a minus minus plus. And if we consider the last surviving contribution, then that's exactly the form we're going to get. We're going to have a plus minus, a plus and a minus. So we have a plus plus minus followed by a minus minus plus, followed again by a plus plus minus. So let me actually skip the remainder of that example. And let's do the case of the n equals 4 all n MHV amplitude. If NEMA fails to show up, I can perhaps go back and do some of the remaining examples and see how much more ink out of Michael's pen I can use up. So, as I mentioned, if we're now looking at the n equals 4 theory, I'm, let's say, going to calculate the amplitude with the external gluons, but that's really the same thing as calculating the superamplitude because this is all packaged into a single object. Or equivalently, I can choose in any contribution, I can choose to put I and j wherever I like because there's some supersymmetry Ward identity that relates it to the contribution that we're interested in. So let's start with the easiest case, which are the four mass boxes. And I can choose to put the two negative helicities on one of the external massive legs. Each leg here is the sum of at least two original momenta, so there's always two momenta here, and I can put the two negative helicities there. So that means that all the remaining external helicities are positive. And then, in order to get a non-vanishing contribution, I have to have negative helicities on the internal lines. And that means I run into a contradiction right away. Because when I'm changing the sign of a momentum, if I'm making everything outward directed on each of the cuts, one side has to be minus and one side has to be plus. So if I would actually put a plus there, which is the only allowed choice, one of these vertices would vanish. And the same thing is going to be true for the three mass boxes. It's not necessarily going to be true for the hard two mass box, but if we look there for a second at what's going on, then again, I have two negative helicities. All these guys are going to be positive. So I have a minus sign here, therefore a plus there. And minus here, I have a plus here, I have a plus here. And so I have to have a negative helicity here, a plus here, a plus here. Now I have two pluses. I can't make the remaining one a plus. It has to be a minus sign. So then I get an MHV amplitude over here, which is very nice, another MHV amplitude over here. And I have two three-point vertices. They're both plus, plus, minus, so they don't necessarily vanish independently. But remember that if we have two adjacent three-point vertices, they have to be of opposite chirality, because otherwise we're enforcing an impossible constraint on the common spinner. So this contribution also vanishes. Or I should say that, I mean, the integral, of course, doesn't vanish. It's the corresponding coefficient that vanishes. In fact, it's only the easy two-mass boxes and, as a degenerate case, the one-mass box that have non-vanishing coefficients. So let's look at the easy two-mass box. And again, I'm going to choose to put the two negative helicities over on that leg over there. So this box, one can label it in different ways, but in an endpoint configuration, it's sufficient to label them by the indices of the two massless legs. And of course, there's different boxes that one can have, ranging really from all the way from a single leg separating them to having all the legs but three sitting in between the two of them on one side. So again, we can label the helicities that we have here, and we're actually forced to have a single helicity configuration. So this sum over helicities, most of the contributions are simply going to vanish for various reasons, because amplitudes vanish. And what we see here is that we actually have two endpoint or M-point MHV amplitudes, and then we have two three-point amplitudes of the opposite chirality. So these are all formulas which we have very simple expressions for. And we would write down.
When you say something, it's plus plus minus.
Plus plus minus, but that's an MHV bar 3-point amplitude, which has a very simple expression.
Plus, plus, plus.
Which are we looking at? This plus plus minus, that's a 3-point, and all the M point are MHV. Yeah, they're MHV bar.
From the other.
Yes, from the other side. They're MHV bar. They're of the same chirality to each other, but they're opposite to the chirality of the M point vertices sitting at the lower left and upper right corners. So you'd simply write out the product of these amplitudes, to know how many legs here, you'd have to simply count. It's a generic expression independent of the of those details. And as we'll see, in fact, the whole of the calculation doesn't really care about that. So the neat thing, of course, is that we have all n expressions. These are the Park-Taylor expressions for these amplitudes, and moreover, most of the factors in those expressions are simple one-term expressions. Most of those factors are completely independent of L1 and L2, and so we can just pull them out of whatever algebraic simplifications we're doing here. Again, to emphasize, we could have solved numerically for L1 and L2, L3, and L4 and simply substituted them in. You could also just substitute them in algebraically, or you can combine things and use momentum conservation. There's, of course, many ways to simplify this expression. Let me just write out the first stage here. So this double bracket notation simply means the product of the angle spinner product starting with one momentum and ending with the other. And so that in this notation, for example, the Park-Taylor formula would simply read ij to the fourth and then 1 to m and then m1. So in fact, you can see that we have the bulk of that formula for the, let's say, the corresponding tree-level object is already there. There are just a few spinner products basically linking the different contributions that are missing. I have written out the, not sure that, uh, don't know if the last line is actually visible, but those of you who have been following the last week or so should be able to fill it in on your own. So, what we can do here is then rewrite this, and I'm going to drop some overall factors of I. So it's exactly the tree level amplitude, which I take by combining this factor and that factor and the ij to the fourth, and supplying some extra factors linking C2 plus 1 and C2 and so on and so forth. I get exactly the tree level amplitude. So, and it's multiplied by a certain set of spinner products involving the loop momenta and the external legs that are at the boundaries of these different masses. So a quick check that we can do is that we expect for the internal spinners that every lambda spinner is going to be partnered with a lambda tilde spinner, since we have the helicities partnered. We can see that over here, that's in fact the case. The L's appear as momenta. And over here, there's always an angle in the denominator paired with a bracket for each of L1 through L4. And again, there's various ways of doing the simplifying algebra here. I'm not going to go through them for you. The thing that one finds when you reduce all of this is you find precisely that factor of that we saw in the denominator of the three-mass box. And so that's it. This is an exercise you could carry out in a few minutes on a sheet of paper, and probably a single sheet of paper if you were very economical and were worried about consuming too much ink out of your pen. And you'd find that the one loop amplitude in n equals 4 is simply equal to the tree amplitude, the MHV tree amplitude, so this is MHV, times the sum over all easy two-mass and one-mass boxes of the box integral times twice its denominator.
C2 plus or minus 1 mean?
So, okay, so these are labels of the external legs. I can be a little bit more explicit that this leg, so that I'm, of course, numbering them from 1 to n, but I haven't really told you where 1 and n are here. It's not really very important. So if this one is labeled C1, then I'm going to label the next leg as C1 plus 1, and the previous leg is going to be C1 minus 1. So what this expression really means, for example, is lambda, to write it out more explicitly, is the lambda spinner corresponding to k C1 minus 1 contracted with the lambda spinner corresponding to k C1. and so on and so forth.
Then you say 2-tenant denominator undercut.
This is the expression for the loop amplitude, and each of these integrals, there's some rational denominator that appears in front, st or st minus m1 squared and 3 squared, and it's that rational function which appears multiplying the integral. And I mean, that's, in a sense, you know that you have to have, if you put in the mu squares to the epsilon, then you need to have something dimensionless here, because the dimensions have to be the same, and that's, so there's going to be some rational function, but. So in the particular case at hand, it's exactly the spurious denominator we saw there. So in the case of n equals 4, the spurious denominators actually cancel algebraically. There's not even any trace of them in the coefficients. But in QCD in general, that's not true. Yes?
So you're saying that all dependence on L's will cancel out?
So the all dependence on L's. I mean, L's have solutions. So I can simplify this by using momentum conservation But I could also be lazy and just plug in the actual solutions for the L's, and of course I'm going to get the same answer. And I mean, I could stand here and do the algebra for you, but
I guess what's not clear is that
would be very illuminating.
You plug in all the solutions.
Yes.
And sum over
you do have to sum over all the solutions, but again, the point is that because of the helicity structure of this amplitude, ultimately all the solutions but one are going to give you a zero answer. So, for example, there would be solutions where. So this solution, sorry, this solution, this is leg C1. So this solution has lambda C1, and this is L1. Wait, I'm looking at the wrong. It's over here. I'm sorry. So lambda C1 is proportional to lambda L1 is proportional to lambda L4. Right? That's one solution. There's going to be another solution where it's the other way around, where it's actually the lambda tildes that are proportional. But if I plug that in over here, this amplitude is going to vanish. So I'm just going to get zero. So in general, you get two non-zero contributions when you sum over the solutions. In this particular example, which is, of course, the simplest, in some sense, the simplest possible all-in example, one of the solutions actually gives you zero. So then when you sum over solutions, you only see one solution.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm just saying that if among the steps, what's not clear, at least to me personally, is that you actually need to sum over all solutions in general in order to get.
Yes, and in general here, I need to sum over all solutions too, and that also includes summing over all the different helicities, except that, so for example, there would have been a contribution where I have, where this solution contributes at the level of this particular corner, so it'd be a plus minus minus, right? So then you'd say, okay, I have to sum over that solution, except the problem is that this other corner, the lower corner, is then going to vanish. So there's a lot of helicity, so all this sort of helicity tracing that I was doing, it's saying, yes, there's a 16-fold sum over helicities, but actually all but one term vanishes, and all that but one term vanishes sort of for generic kind of supersymmetric Ward identity type of reasons. So in particular, suppose you're doing not the MHV, but the NMHV amplitude, then you'll discover that there are, in general, three mass boxes, and you do get surviving spurious denominators, et cetera, but I mean, the basic idea of how you carry out the calculation is very similar. Yes, we should stop here. Yes.